This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's not hard to find a reason to worry these days, whether it's about climate change or terrorism or the rise of artificial intelligence, the future of liberal democracy, on and on. You get the point. But how do we balance all of these long-term concerns for the future with the fact that there are also more immediate and urgent concerns about putting food on the table or perhaps escaping war zones? Well, in his latest book, historian and author Yuval Noah Harari acknowledges that tension, but says we also must pay attention to the immediate future because it has consequences for us all. But he says we can face the uncertainty with clarity. This hour On Point, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. You can join us on air or online. Do you think we as humans are equipped to survive the 21st century, the very 21st century we are creating? Are you worried about artificial intelligence, about who owns all of that data we're pouring out there? What is your question about humanity and about the future for Yuval Harari? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Yuval Harari joins us now. He's in Washington today, and he's a lecturer at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where he specializes in world history. He's also author of the worldwide bestsellers Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. They've been translated into more than 45 languages, sold more than 12 million copies. Likely the same thing's going to happen to his latest book, which is out just this week. It's called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. There's an excerpt at onpointradio.org. Yuval Harari, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. It's good to be here again.
It's very good to have you. First of all, you've written about the past. You've written about the future. But I just want to ask you an overall arching question about how you view our present or our immediate present. Are you an optimist about it or a pessimist?
Well, I think we can summarize humanity's condition in three simple statements. Things are better than ever, things are quite bad, and things can get much, much worse. Whether this makes me an optimist or a pessimist, it's up to you.
But things are better than they have been, things
yes.
are quite bad, and things can get worse makes it sound like all of the above.
But maybe the most important statement is the first one, that things are still better than they ever were before, which means that humanity can do things to improve the situation. If you think about our past achievements, maybe our biggest achievement ever has been to overcome famine, which has been the greatest enemy of humankind since the beginning of history. For most of history, most humans lived on the brink of starvation, but today more people die from obesity than from starvation. More people die from eating too much than from eating too little, which is actually an amazing achievement. And we have almost completely abolished natural famine from the world. Natural famine is famine caused by natural disasters like floods and droughts and so forth. There are still a lot of people starving, but this is just political famine. If people today starve to death, and there are people starving to death, it is only because some government or politician wants them to starve to death. In technological and economic terms, there is no problem for the first time in history of feeding everybody.
Right. So this is along the lines of what Steven Pinker wrote about, right, in his book Enlightenment Now, that he says we should be optimists about how far humanity has come. It's just that our perceptions are wrong.
I'm not sure if we should be optimistic. We should be at least have gratitude and acknowledge our past achievements. And this is also important in order to give us hope about the future. But we have a set of new and unprecedented challenges ahead of us. I would say the three most important are nuclear war, climate change, and technological disruption. Even if we manage to prevent nuclear war and climate change, it's still almost certain that artificial intelligence and biotechnology will completely disrupt our job markets, our political systems, and even our bodies and brains in the next few decades. And we will need all our wisdom and a lot of global cooperation in order to deal with these challenges.
Well, I want to talk about some of those challenges with you and your view of them in detail in just a moment. But if I may, can I just quote briefly from the introduction of the book? Because there's something you write that's so interesting. You say, if the future of humanity is decided in your absence because you are too busy feeding and clothing your kids, you and they will not be exempt from the consequences. This is unfair, but who said history was fair? And then you go on to write, as a historian, I cannot give people food or clothes, but I can try to offer some clarity, thereby helping to level the global playing field. If this empowers even a handful of additional people to join the debate about the future of our species, I have done my job. So in the process of writing this book or the series of essays, where is it that, you know, as a historian, that you went searching for that clarity?
Everywhere, basically. I mean, you can't focus, if you really want to understand what's happening, you cannot focus on just one field or one discipline like economics or computer science or biology. You have to take everything into account. And this is largely because what's happening today in the world is shaped by the combination of several enormous revolutions. I would say the two most important ones are the revolutions in infotech and in biotech. And what we are seeing now is the merger of infotech and biotech, of computer science and biology. And this gives rise to the greatest challenges we are facing. I would summarize it succinctly by saying that we are now hackable animals.
Huh.
For the first time in history, we should realize that we can be hacked. And hacking humans is based on bringing together insights from biology with the power of computers.
Okay, so let's talk more about that, because obviously technology, both small and large, is a defining feature of our present. I mean, there possibly are many reasons to be pessimistic about its future development and use. But on the other hand, I mean, it's never one thing or another. I want to acknowledge that. But on the other hand, there still are many techno-utopians who, you know, point to previous waves of technological development and say, these are exactly the things that have got us to this place that we were talking about a minute ago of incredible human advancement.
Yes, I think that almost all technologies can be used both for good and for evil. The technology itself never tells us what to do with it. If you think about radio, for example, so radio can be used to do something like NPR and to enlighten people. And at the same time, we have a lot of examples from the 20th century how radio can be used to brainwash people with propaganda. And like, you know, the main propaganda tool of the Nazi regime was radio. So it's the same radio. The radio waves don't care. The radio technology doesn't care whether you use it to broadcast Hitler or to broadcast NPR. It's up to us to use the technology wisely.
Hmm. So tell me then, when you look across the globe, where are the places or examples that we are not using technology wisely?
What worries me most at present is the beginning of an AI arms race. Between basically almost all the leading countries in the world. 5 years ago, we weren't there. People were just beginning to realize the immense potential of AI. But now we are at the beginning of an arms race, not just between China and the US, but between many countries. And this is very frightening, because it means that it's unlikely we will be able to regulate the explosive potential of artificial intelligence if we are in the middle of an arms race. And this can lead to terrible consequences, from inventions like autonomous weapon systems, killer robots, to things like digital dictatorships, in which the ability to hack human beings is used in order to manipulate and control humans in ways which were unthinkable a couple of decades ago.
Mm. I mean, one might argue that's already happening through social media.
It's beginning to happen. And I would say that things like the Cambridge Analytica scandal, it's actually good that this story erupted, because it's a wake-up call. It's still just the tiny tip of the iceberg. And much, much worse kinds of manipulations are waiting us down the road, unless we take action in the near future to prevent it.
Mm. But I wonder, I mean, is the... Should the concern that we have or should have about artificial intelligence sort of, you know, to use a Hollywood example, along the lines of the Terminator, right, where AI and robots in the future become virtually, you know, truly autonomous and sentient and become our robotic overlords? Or is it that they will never actually defy their programming, and that's the problem, because the power behind which way to direct this artificial intelligence may be concentrated in the hands of a few?
Yeah, I would definitely worry about the second scenario. The problem with killer robots is not that they will rebel against us. The problem is just the opposite, that they will never refuse any order that you give them. And then if you have a benign government, that's fine. But if you have an evil government, and we had quite a few of those in history, then the consequences are terrible. And the danger is that an enormous power will be concentrated in the hands of a tiny elite. And without any limitations or without any oversight, I wouldn't worry too much about robots and computers gaining consciousness. I know that this is a scenario which is very fond in Hollywood and in science fiction, but we have absolutely no indication that computers and robots are anywhere on the road to developing consciousness. Actually, science fiction causes a lot of confusion to the degree that people don't even realize what's the difference between intelligence and consciousness. They think that artificial intelligence, by definition, will also become conscious. So,
well, if I may, I just want to we have a minute to go before the break, but as a fan of science fiction, I would say that science fiction, good science fiction, actually allows us to really engage with that question about consciousness and technology in a setting that's in the future. The good stuff helps us understand that question.
Yes, I mean, we can discuss it further after the break. I think it's an extremely important subject to discuss in order to dispel the confusion and bring clarity to this issue of intelligence and consciousness.
Okay, so let's do just exactly that. We're speaking today with Yuval Noah Harari. He's an author and historian, author of several best-selling books, including Sapiens and Homo Deus. His new book is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a bi-weekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Domenico. All week long, Brett Kavanaugh will face his Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, he's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how he could transform the Supreme Court for a generation.
The NPR Politics podcast will be following those hearings, and we'll hop in the studio every day to break down what you need to know.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Yuval Noah Harari. He's author of several worldwide bestsellers, including Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, where he looks at the past of humanity, and Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, where he looks at our collective future. His latest book really takes a sharp historian's perspective of where we are now, and it's called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.com. And Yuval, we were before the break, you and I were discussing a little bit about the merits or lack of merit for science fiction and how it's helping us understand, you know, what AI might bring in the future. And I pushed back a little, so I'm anxious to hear your response.
Well, first, science fiction, I would say, is the most important artistic genre today because it shapes people's understanding of the new technologies and of the new challenges. And therefore, it's very, very important. And in many cases, it does an excellent job. But in the case of intelligence and consciousness, I think it brings more confusion. I would say very briefly that intelligence is the ability to solve problems. Consciousness is the ability to feel things, like pain and pleasure and love and hate. Now, in humans and other mammals, like chimpanzees and dogs, consciousness and intelligence go together. We solve problems by having feelings. But computers work in a completely different way. And there is no indication that they are anywhere on the road to developing consciousness. Just as airplanes fly much faster than birds without ever developing feathers, so computers are likely to become far more intelligent than us without ever developing consciousness or feelings. And the danger is that authority in the world will increasingly shift to super intelligent but completely non-conscious entities.
Okay. Can I just jump in here? I am very taken by your analogy with birds and airplanes. Mm-hmm. But here's another way of looking at it. Given that there's a metaphor for the human brain of being, you know, a computational black box, right? It's just taking in lots of inputs from our environment in every imaginable dimension, and it's processing those inputs, and then some of the output that it spits out of the human brain we experience as feelings, right? Mm-hmm. So what's to stop a future artificial intelligence from doing the same, from taking in all its inputs, processing that information, and then spitting out something that perhaps the artificial intelligence experiences what we would, as humans would interpret as feelings?
Well, we don't understand consciousness at all in humans as well. And it's not inevitable that, it's not impossible that computers will someday develop consciousness. We don't know. There is just no indication that this is happening. Very often people expect artificial intelligence to develop consciousness because they want computers and robots to understand them better. In order to perform many jobs and many tasks, we need to understand human feelings, human emotions, human behavior. If we want a self-driving car, the self-driving car must be able to predict human behavior, like kids running after a ball in the street. In order to have an AI doctor diagnosing our diseases, the AI doctor must also be able to understand our emotions and moods and take them into account. And a doctor that can't take into account human emotions is not a good doctor. Now, we tend to assume that in order to understand us, the computer will have to have feelings of its own. But this is just not true. Emotions and feelings are biochemical patterns.
Right.
And a self-driving car will be able to predict human behavior even better than a human driver without having emotions of its own. And an AI doctor, just in the same way that the AI doctor can diagnose flu or cancer, it can diagnose fear and anger, which are also just biochemical patterns. And one of the scary scenarios is that actually computers will be so much better than humans in understanding our emotions and relating to them that we will become unaccustomed to these humans who don't care about us, because the computers, in a sense, will care about us much more. I mean, an AI doctor will never be upset because her husband or her children did something this morning that upset her. No, he will be 100% focused on me and my emotions, and will know exactly how I feel, even better than I know it, and will react in exactly the right way. We will get the best emotional care ever from something that doesn't feel anything. And this is a very scary scenario if you think about it deeply enough.
Yes, it's scary because you're talking about a non-biological entity with, as you said, no consciousness. But perhaps another reason why it could be worrisome is if we're talking about a future that's dominated by technology that's not, yoked to the burdens of consciousness, then, as we were saying earlier, those people who are controlling that technology have, extraordinary, almost unimaginable power over billions of human beings.
Exactly. I mean, again, to come back to the idea of hacking human beings, if you can hack the human brain, then your own brain, your own innermost desires and feelings could be manipulated more and more effectively by all kinds of corporations and governments. Maybe your amygdala is working for Putin and you don't know it. You feel things, and you feel them as the most... I mean, this is already beginning to happen today, and this was the warning sign of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, that somebody out there can hack your own fear, can hack your own hatred, and then use that against you. And you don't know it because you experience it as your own feelings.
But hasn't this always been happening? I mean, isn't that what propaganda is?
Yeah, it was always the case in history, but previously you couldn't really hack individuals effectively. So propaganda worked like carpet bombing. You aimed for the common lowest denominator of millions of people. Now propaganda is becoming more and more like precision-guided munitions. It is tailored just for you. So they, whoever they are, they can know, for example, I don't know, that maybe I don't like immigration. I have a bias against immigrants. So they will show me a fake news story about an immigrant gang raping local women. And I will easily believe it because I already have this bias, this weakness. Mm-hmm. And they know, maybe, that my neighbor has an opposite bias. She is in favor of immigration, and she thinks that anybody who opposes it is a fascist, racist idiot. And they will show her a completely different fake news story about, I don't know, a neo-Nazi gang murdering immigrants. Mm-hmm. And she will believe that very easily because, again, she has a bias towards that direction. And now try to have a conversation between me and my neighbor. It's almost impossible. These kinds of tricks are based on getting to know our individual weaknesses and using them against us.
Right. You know, if I may, though, I mean, isn't this one of the lessons that we need to draw, one of the endless lessons that we need to draw from this moment, that when it comes to staving off the potential exploitation of technology, the answer isn't more technology. The answer is better regulation of human social, economic, and political systems.
One answer is better regulation. Another answer is to use technology to fight against technology. Yes, we have now an AI systems, big data algorithms that hack us in the service of some corporation or government, but it can be reversed. Just as our computer has an antivirus that protects it against all kinds of hackers, maybe our brain also needs an antivirus, a system that monitors us in our service, not in the service of anybody else, and gets to know our own biases and weaknesses and protects us whenever somebody is trying to hijack our attention or to manipulate us by using our own weaknesses. You know, the dictum, the recommendation to get to know yourself better, this is the oldest advice in the book. Saints and sages from Socrates and Jesus and Buddha have been telling this to people for thousands of years. But in the past, you did not have competition. Mm. If in the days of Socrates, you failed to get to know yourself better, you were still a black box to the rest of humanity. But now you have competition. As you hear this conversation, there are all kinds of corporations and governments that are right now trying to hack you. And if they get to know you better than you know yourself, then they can sell you anything they want, whether it's a product or a politician. And since most people, I mean, getting to know yourself, especially your weaknesses, is such a hard job that many people may need the help of technology to protect themselves against the new technology.
So then, I mean, this gets to a point that you make in the book. They're getting to know us better than we know ourselves because of all the data that we are willingly and even unconsciously putting out there in virtually every interaction that we have every day. So,
yeah.
I mean, it seems as if part of what you're saying is an absolute necessity for our present, let alone our future, is the better regulation of who owns all that data.
Definitely. I would say that this is one of the top three political issues of the day, or should be, is who owns the data? You know, in ancient times, the most important asset in the economy was land. So politics was largely a struggle to control land. Then in the last 200 years, since the Industrial Revolution, machines replaced land as the most important economic asset. So politics became the struggle to control the machines. And now data is replacing machines as the most important asset, and politics is really becoming a struggle to control the flows of data. The problem is that we have almost no experience in regulating the ownership of data. We have thousands of years of experience regulating the ownership of land. We know how to do it. We know what it means to own land. If I own a piece of land, a field, I can build a fence around it, place a gate, I stand at the gate, I decide who comes in, who goes out. But what does it mean to own my personal data? How do I protect it? And data, unlike a field, data can be everywhere and nowhere at the same time. You can have as many copies of it as you want. There are quite a number of interesting ideas today about how to regulate data, but we have very little experience.
Well, also, I mean, I'm going to get to some callers here because there's so many who have good questions. But if I may, there's the presumption that everyone cares, but millions of people don't care. They don't care who owns their data.
Yes, because it's still not as big a political issue as it should be. And partly it's simply because it's a very complicated subject. People tend to care not about the important things, but about the understandable things. Mm-hmm. They prefer to argue about immigration and not about data, because in immigration, you feel that you know what you're talking about, whatever your opinion is. But with data, it's just so complicated. It's like, you know, it happens in so many places in life. Like you have a meeting of the company staff, and you have two items on the agenda. First item is a suggestion of the treasurer to replace the pension fund of all the workers. Second item is which kind of coffee machine to buy for the office. You will have a 5 minutes discussion of the first item because nobody understands it, and then a 2 hours argument about the coffee machine. Why? Not because it's important, but because people feel they understand it.
Yeah. If I may, though, I mean, on your point about, I take your larger point to heart, but regarding immigration, I would say it's both complicated and important. But, you know, Yuval, I feel like I'm traveling down a road with you, and every step we take, there are little paths that branch off with the multiplicity of questions that we could follow. And I'm not sure which direction to go. So if I may, I'm going to allow our listeners to ask some of their questions.
Yes,
of
certainly.
You. Dimitri is calling from Lake Worth, Florida. You're on the air.
Terrific. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks.
What's your question, Dimitri?
Okay, so your actually was more of a comment. You asked, are we ready for the 21st century? Are we prepared as humans for the 21st century? And quite honestly, I'd have to say no. It's evolving so fast, as you guys have been talking about, and like you just said, so many branches down the, you know, in the conversation, so many questions coming. I don't think as humans that we're prepared for actually understanding which questions to truly ask and then what are the answers to get to. And a lot of the things that we're seeing today that we've had, just a couple of points. One of the things was, you guys were talking about consciousness. Well, not too long ago, Google did a competition where it was a Chinese game. They set up an AI bot to learn the game. In the middle of learning the game, what Google engineers realized was that the AI bots were starting to talk to each other in their own language and were modifying the programming code, so much so the engineers turned it off. Because they were like, wait a minute, we don't understand what's happening. So that was intelligence that was being created by the AI itself. A lot of the examples that you've talked about us being programmed, yeah, they all exist today. NPL is something that, neuro-linguistic programming language is something that has existed for a while. It's done on such a small scale on an individual basis. You're talking about basically using something like that in AI on a very large scale, and that's extremely scary to think about what you can do in controlling people.
Dimitri, thank you. I'm just going to jump in here because we do have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but thank you so much for your thought. Yuval Harari, you had a response there.
Yes, I think that things are progressing at such a rapid pace that it is a big question whether we can deal with it, both as a species and as individuals. We have absolutely no idea how the world would look like in 2050. This is the first time in history, I think, that we really have absolutely no idea how the world would look like in 30 years. Now, it was always impossible to predict the future. You could never predict the political revolutions, the earthquakes, the epidemics. But still, throughout history, when you looked 30 years to the future, you knew how the job market will basically look like. If you live in the Middle Ages, 30 years from now, yes, the Vikings might invade, there might be a huge epidemic, but still most people will be peasants. So you know to teach your kids how to plow the field and how to shepherd the flocks and so forth. You also know that in 30 years, humans will still have the same bodies, they will have the same brains. You know that family structure and gender identities will be more or less as they are today. But in 2018, when you think about the world of 2050, we don't know any of that. The only thing we know is that it will be a completely different world, and that most of the things that kids learn today in school will be probably irrelevant by the time they are 40 or 50. The one thing that people will need to do, certainly, is to constantly learn and constantly reinvent themselves. Mm. You will have to reinvent yourself repeatedly, not just once. And so this is also the best bet about what to teach kids today.
Well, we're talking with Yuval Noah Harari. He's an author and historian. His latest book out this week is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. Really fascinating conversation. We're going to get to more calls when we come back from the break. What's your question for Yuval Harari? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking today with Yuval Noah Harari. His new book is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. Yuval, the book is actually, it touches on so many fascinating areas. I'm just going to acknowledge here that we're not going to get to near any one of them. I think we maybe have touched on one out of your 21 lessons. But let me get some more callers here who have things to say. Dan is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Dan.
Hi, Meghna. I was disappointed to hear your guest say that we don't know what the world is going to look like in 2050. We only know that we're going to have to reinvent ourselves. And it seems like we are going to have to reinvent ourselves because AI is going to march forward without any discussion in the human community that describes the value that it has for us. He says that we're going to still have the same brains and the same bodies, but this culture completely dismisses the human body as inadequate, and that we must do everything we can with artificial intelligence to limit the limitations of our corporal existence. I think we should ask ourselves the question of why are we giving up on the human body, its limitations, and the richness that we've created with its limitations?
Dan, thank you for your call. Yuval, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First, I would just say that no, I'm not sure we will have the same body and the same brain in a couple of decades because of the development of biotechnology. And this is part of the danger that we are likely to use the new technology to either replace or re-engineer even our parts of our bodies and brains. And the danger here is that we have no idea what the consequences will be because we still have a very limited understanding of the true human potential. There is a huge mismatch, and this is throughout history, between the human ability to manipulate and the human ability to understand. In many cases, we know how to manipulate things, even though we don't understand them deeply. It's much easier to build a dam over a river than to understand what will be the consequences for the entire ecological system. For thousands of years, we have been changing the world outside us, even though we had a very limited understanding of the complexity of the ecological system, and no wonder that we now face an ecological collapse. The same thing may happen with our internal system in the coming decades. Up till now, we have changed the world outside us. From now onwards, we are also likely to change more and more the world inside us, our bodies, our brains, our minds. But because we don't really understand the complexity of the human mind, the full potential of human beings, the result of all these manipulations might be an internal ecological collapse.
Yuval, can I just jump? Forgive me for interrupting, but but I have you've sparked a question in my mind. many questions, to be perfectly honest. But the line of thinking that you were taking us down, it suddenly occurred to me, not to put it too bluntly, but so what? Aren't you also describing, you know, what could be seen as the processes of evolution writ large?
Yes, but, you know, in natural selection, 99% of mutations are bad for you or ineffective. And the costs of making a mistake will be enormous, not only for humanity, but for the rest of life. We are now really becoming the gods of planet Earth. We are acquiring divine abilities of creation. And I don't mean this as a metaphor, really literally. Just as the Bible describes God creating animals and plants and humans according to his wishes, now we are gaining the ability to start re-engineering and manufacturing living beings, life forms. And we are relatively irresponsible gods. We don't even realize what powers we have. So my fear is that we will use our enormous powers without thinking about it too much. We are really conducting now an enormous experiment on billions of guinea pigs, billions of humans, and nobody knows what the consequences are. And the worst thing is that we cannot regulate this experiment unless we have some kind of global agreement on it. And in the present political atmosphere, the chances of getting a global agreement on how to use carefully and wisely artificial intelligence and bioengineering, the chances are getting smaller and smaller.
Well, because of the forces of nationalism and tribalism are in ascendance.
Yes.
To say the least.
To say the least, yeah.
Okay, well, let's get another call here. Brian is calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. You're on the air, Brian.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question concerns the issue of spirituality, which I feel like you mentioned talking about evil governments or consciousness or even God as a recent. And how do you see the spiritual dimension the evolution of consciousness? Mm-hmm. How do you see the role in that as far as science and technology? How do you see it integrating? And do you see this allowing us to be able to think more and understand more the depths that we don't know we manipulate?
Brian, thank you. Yuval, go ahead.
Well, I think that it's more important than ever before, because questions that for thousands of years were considered spiritual and philosophical questions with little impact on practical economics and engineering are questions like, what is the meaning of life? What is humanity? What is free will? What is consciousness? All these questions that philosophers and saints have been debating and exploring for thousands of years, they suddenly become practical questions of engineering. The engineers are taking over. And whereas, you know, philosophers and sages and saints, they are very patient people. They can discuss a problem for thousands of years without resolving it. Engineers are extremely impatient people. They need an answer within a couple of months. And if we don't, this is really the time that, you know, philosophers have been waiting for thousands of years. Finally, we need an answer to these questions. So I think it's more important than ever before.
Okay, but so then how do we resolve this, though? Because, I mean, I hear you saying that it's more important than ever before to perhaps, you know, find some moral grounding within ourselves as the human race, as a human species, but also, of course, as individuals. But there is part of your book in a chapter that you've titled Post-Truth, when you say that regarding religion in particular, you say when 1,000 people believe some made-up story for a month, that's fake news. But when 1 billion people believe it for 1,000 years, that's religion. So where do we search for this moral grounding then, if you're equating religion, the great global religions, to 1,000-year-long delusion around fake news?
Well, first of all, we need to differentiate spirituality from religion. Spirituality is about questions. Religion is about answers. Spirituality is when you ask some big question like, who am I? Or what is the good? And you embark on a quest to find the answer. Religion is when somebody comes and tells you, this is the answer. You must believe it. You shouldn't question it. If you question this, you go to hell or we burn you. And to say, you know, it's a bit... many people will be taken aback by the idea that religion is fake news, but actually this is something every religious person, or almost every religious person, will agree that all religions are fake news except one, except of course mine. You ask a Jew, they will tell you Judaism is the truth, of course, but Christianity, that's fake news. I mean, all these news about Jesus rising from the dead and being the Son of God, this is fake news. Ask a Christian, the Christian will say, oh, no, Christianity is the truth. But Islam, all these news about Muhammad being visited by the Archangel Gabriel and the Quran being dictated by God, this is just fake news. Ask a Muslim about Hinduism, you get the same response. So... And of course, this is true not only about religion. If you look at any large-scale human cooperation throughout history, you will almost always find at the basis some fictional story. It's true of many secular ideologies. It's true of nationalism. It's true even of the economic system.
Right. I mean, humanity, every culture you can think of is founded on great stories.
Yes, fictional stories are the basis for human cooperation. And with all the talk these days about fake news being something new and blaming it just on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you don't need these kinds of technologies to spread very dangerous fake news. If you go back 1,000 years to some small medieval village, you don't have Facebook or Twitter, but you do have the village gossip coming to you and telling you, well, you know this old woman who lives by the forest? I just saw her flying on a broomstick. And within an hour, you would have a raging mob of villagers with pitchforks and torches ready to burn this old woman to death. So fake news is it's a big problem, but it's not a new problem.
But... So, Yuval, if I may, we've been spending the past hour having a conversation where it seems as if at every turn, what you're saying is that we as cultures and societies and as an entire species are radically under or ill-equipped to deal with the very future we are creating. That is a very melancholy feeling. Certainly down... come now. I mean, I'm telling you honestly, but down to the level of individuals, I'm sure there are thousands of people listening right now who are saying, well, then what can we do?
There are many things we can do from the level of individuals to the level of governments and entire countries. On the level of the individual, I would say the most important thing now is to get to know yourself better. You are now in a race with all these organizations and corporations that try to hack you. You must get to know yourself, to get to know your mind, your weaknesses, and not allow them to be manipulated by these external forces. Another thing that individuals can and should do is join an organization. If you care about something, you should know that humans are far more effective when they work in cooperation than when they work in isolation. So choose one organization and join it in order to really make a difference. And it goes all the way to the level of countries and governments. Technology is never deterministic. You can use the same technology to create heaven or to create hell. If you look at the 20th century, you could use radio and electricity and trains to create communist dictatorships or to create liberal democracies. The trains did not care about it. It was up to humans to decide. And it's the same with AI and bioengineering. We can use them to provide the best healthcare in history or to build the worst dictatorships in history. I would say that the key to creating paradise and not hell is to have global cooperation. All these problems are global in nature. It's not something that a single country can do by itself. If you want, again, if you want to prevent the rise of killer robots, if the US bans killer robots or bans genetic engineering on human babies, it won't help much unless the Chinese and the Russians and the Germans have similar regulations, because nobody would like to stay behind. If you don't have a global agreement on that, then every country will say, yes, we don't know to do, we don't want to do all these dangerous developments and experiments, but we can't trust the other guys not to do it. And we must do it first, because we can't be left behind.
And we obviously have had global agreements in the past, right? I mean, the nuclear test ban treaty, for example, one of them. But it does seem that as if we're quite far away from achieving a world where such worldwide agreements, new sets of them, can come to pass.
No, we are actually much closer than ever before. There is greater global cooperation in the last 20 or 30 years than ever before in human history, in almost all fields, from economics to even sports. If you think about the latest soccer, the FIFA
World Cup,
Cup in Russia. So try to think about getting Argentinians and French and Japanese to play a game together in Russia 1,000 years ago. This is absolutely impossible, not just because the Japanese don't know that Argentina or America even exists, but because no game is being played by all people around the world and they can't agree on the rules. And on another level, you have nuclear weapons that in the 1950s and 60s, almost everybody thought that the Cold War will end in a nuclear Armageddon, which will destroy human civilization, and it didn't happen. Instead, we are still today living in the most peaceful era that ever existed in history. So,
in terms of how many humans are dying at the hands of other humans.
Yeah, if you look at there are still definitely many wars in the world. I come from the Middle East, so I know this perfectly well. But compared to any previous time in history, we are in a better situation. Now, it will not be easy, of course. We should never underestimate human stupidity. It's one of the most powerful forces in history, is human stupidity. And unfortunately, especially when it comes to war, there is an imbalance between wisdom and stupidity. It takes a lot of wise people to make peace, but sometimes it's enough to have a single fool in order to have war. So this is definitely a big problem. I don't know what will happen, but I think there is hope.
I hope so, too. I mean, we've just got 60 seconds left here to go. And if I may, we were talking about stories beforehand. Did you know that the image right now that's popped into my head, the story that's in my mind, is that of Sisyphus? I feel like we're pushing against that boulder and it will inevitably roll over us, but we'll keep pushing against it.
I think that, yes.
Should I be more optimistic than that?
I mean, we are good in solving problems as humans, but every problem we solve just creates a new problem in its stead. And that's the way it has been for thousands of years. And yes, this is probably unlikely to change. But at least the immediate problems we are facing now, I think we have a good chance of solving them if we work together.
Well, Yuval Noah Harari, author and historian. He's author of the bestsellers, the worldwide bestsellers, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. His latest book out this week is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And again, we have an excerpt of it, at onpointradio.org. Yuval, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, and thank all the listeners.
What a journey this show can be. That's it for this hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.